This podcast is brought to you by AJ Bell and Shares Magazine. Shares Magazine is published by AJ Bell Media, part of AJ Bell.
We recorded this week's Money and Markets podcast before we got the latest update from the Bank of England on interest rates. So I thought I'd just hop on before you got the full episode to talk you through what happened. And it was exactly what was expected. Interest rates were held firm at 5.25%, a 16-year high. Now that's a hold for the fifth consecutive time. What did change and what has got markets excited is that two hawks, two of those who'd voted for a rate hike last time around, joined the hold brigade. One voted for a cut. Now, Andrew Bailey said it was too soon for that, but we are definitely heading in the right direction. What did that mean for markets? Well, looking this lunchtime, the FTSE 100 is headed to its highest level in a year, up 113 points, and the FTSE 250 up 186 points. Now, most investors and analysts like me still think that the Bank of England will only cut rates for the first time in the third quarter. So that's probably the August meeting. But when you look at market expectation this lunchtime, well, nearly 70% chance on a first cut in June, with almost three quarter point reductions being priced in over 2024. Now, let's get on with the episode. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Money and Markets podcast. We've got a packed show for you because this is our ISA special. I'm Danny Hewson. I'm joined by Charlene Young. Hi, Charlene.
Hi, Danny. Hi, everyone. Now, are you one of the many investors who want to know what other people are up to? So not necessarily to copy them, but more out of curiosity. So Dan Coatsworth is going to lift the lid on where some of AJ Bell's own customers are putting their ISA money later in the show.
Our interview this week is with Lawrence Burns, Deputy Manager of Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, which just so happens to be one of those top holdings in AJ Bell customers' ISAs. It has had a bit of a rough ride over the past couple of years, and I asked him if he believes things are getting back on track.
We're also going to be joined by Laura Suter, who will explain how lifetime ISAs can help first-time buyers shave years off that slog to get the deposit together, compared to using a standard ISA. Plus, with changes to the high income threshold for child benefit, I'm going to talk you through how you can turn that windfall into a chunky nest egg for your kids using a junior ISA.
All that, and we'll have the usual markets news, including reaction to the decision to hold interest rates by the US Federal Reserve, not just to hold rates, but the narrative that they still expect three rate cuts over the course of this year. But Charlene, we have to start with the latest UK inflation figures. We are recording this on Thursday morning. You'll have already heard all about the Bank of England, but let's stick with inflation figures because it was good news for households.
Yeah, so yesterday we heard that the consumer price index came in at 3.4% for the month of February. So that's down from 2 months where it's been stuck at 4%. So that good news for households was particularly on food inflation, which is now slowing down to 5%. Now, remember a year ago, we had that record high of 18%, thanks in the main to those salad shortages that I'm sure we're glad to see the back of. It's a bit of a tongue twister there. So prices are cooling just about everywhere. So service inflation, core inflation, both lower, clothing and footwear down, and recreation and culture also down. But it's not all good news as prices at the pump, as you may have noticed, have ticked up again and housing costs are up. So it's not a surprise that lots of mortgage holders are feeling the impact of those higher interest rates and rental prices are high because many landlords are dealing with the same. So whilst the energy price cap did come down in January, people have actually been paying more this February compared to last February because the government's no longer making those energy support scheme payments. And though some prices have come down, those essentials in supermarkets mainly, thanks for competition ongoing for market share, when we talk about inflation coming down, that just means on average that prices aren't rising as fast as they were. So they're still rising, but just not as much as they were last year. And crucially, CPI is still above that Bank of England 2% target.
Yeah, and I'm afraid that good news didn't really do an awful lot for London markets. But comments from the Federal Reserve, the US central bank, that it does still see three rate cuts this year did give a serious lift to global stocks. Yeah, I mean, the fact that he said that the risks of achieving our inflation goals are coming into better balance was enough to really lift markets, which have kind of been in a bit of a doldrums over the last week or so. It didn't matter that the decision was to leave rates untouched because the market is focused on what might happen next. And they've been a bit burnt at the start of the year, where thinking that maybe there will be more rate cuts than they're now pricing in. So there has been this little bit of concern that maybe they might be disappointed again, that there might be the Fed becoming even more stubborn over changing monetary policy. But that does appear to have been blown out of the water last night. We saw US equities rally. We saw that positivity then extend across Asia and into Europe Thursday morning. The FTSE 100 was up just over 1% in early trading. And we saw gains across the board. I mean, there were only six stocks that actually fell in early trading, including some that would fall under the defensive category. So things like British American Tobacco. So when we have a sort of mood like this, we tend to call it risk on. So then they tend to gravitate towards companies with decent earnings growth potential rather than stodgy ones. So all in all, quite good news.
Thanks, Danny. And we've got some market news on some London-listed big beasts. So turning to Unilever and AstraZeneca.
Yeah, this really was something that investors have been waiting to hear from Unilever, that they were really responding to concerns by investors that Unilever had lost its way under its previous boss. Hans Schumacher has said that he wants to do fewer things better with greater impact. And he's really doubled down on that with the announcement that he wants to save about £684 million over the next 3 years. And to do that, it's announced 7,500 job cuts globally, and also that it is going to spin off its ice cream division. Now, you know, this is a company that's got so many fingers in so many pots. It makes things from Marmite to Hellmann's mayonnaise to Dove soap. And then you have ice cream, the likes of Ben and Jerry's. Now, those things are very different. They work differently. They've got a different market. They are, of course, tend to be bought only when the sun shines in the main. So this does make sense. But what it also has started already is jungle drums beating about where a potential demerged ice cream business would be listed. Now, remember, it is managed from Rotterdam, so there's been a lot of speculation that they might plump for Amsterdam. They might be tempted by New York, but clearly, you know, with Unilever listed in London, there's a big hope that London will grab that. And I just want to be very brief talking about AstraZeneca, because it did see losses on the day that it announced it was shelling out for another big medical company. This was $2 billion for Fusion Pharmaceuticals. Share price dipped a little bit. I think investors, they don't like to see companies paying over the odds for other companies. So we did see share prices fall because it spent $3.5 billion over the past couple of weeks on this pipeline. But it is all about making sure that it doesn't have this patent cliff edge, because they can't rely on past blockbuster treatments forever. And they're really now investing in the new generation of technology, the kind of stuff that some of its competitors like Eli Lilly have already invested in. So I think the fact that it has bought these two companies, it will have really kicked the tires. It will have figured out how they fit into the whole and how they can harness then the knowledge and techniques to create better power for them going forward.
And it would not be a markets pod without some AI chat. So we've got some news from Nvidia, Microsoft, and Apple.
Yeah, I mean, Nvidia's the AI darling, isn't it? And it made sure, really, that it was going to remain at the forefront of investors' minds when we are talking about AI by unveiling a brand new superchip. Now, I'm afraid I don't know a huge amount about quantum computing. However, we are told that it is the ultimate sci-fi dream maker. General purpose humanoid robotics are in there, which, to be honest with you, I'm a little bit scared by. But Nvidia once again saw shares jump up again. It was talking CEO Jensen Huang saying that it potentially has a huge market. And of course, that is exactly what investors want to hear. Briefly, Apple has been really on the back foot when it comes to AI. Everyone's been very excited about the fact that it sort of dangled these carrots that it is looking at AI. It will have a big announcement. It's reportedly in talks to add Google's Gemini AI product to its iPhones, to its next iOS operating system update, which did get people a little bit excited, although there's been lots of chat about how that might actually work in principle and also whether it would really be a good thing for Apple itself. And just finally, Microsoft has managed to grab the services of the British DeepMind co-founder Mustafa Suleiman. I mean, he is a tech giant, a UK tech god, really. So the fact that he has jumped ship, because he's been Team Google really all the way, so the fact that Microsoft have managed to bring him into the fold has really also caught investors' attention. So, I mean, AI, it always makes headlines, but another thing that does make headlines, Charlene, is pensions. And before we move on to our ISA special, let's just touch on a couple of the headlines that have been in the papers this morning. We're recording Thursday morning, and reaction to comments made by Jeremy Hunt to the House of Lords Economic Committee that the triple lock will have to come under review in the coming years as an aging population puts greater strain on the public finances. I don't think there's any surprise that pensioners aren't happy, shall they?
No, they are not. And it's quite an interesting move from the Chancellor so soon after a budget where some pensioners say they felt completely left out of, because the cuts to national insurance, of course, won't benefit them. I think what's clearly unsustainable here is that kind of constant will they, won't they, that we've seen every time the triple lock could come up for possible review. And again, it goes back to public finances. If the triple lock is maintained, then then what public services are going to have to give to kind of balance the books? And what does it mean actually for the state pension age itself? Will it need to be increased faster? So I think kind of very much our view is it's really time for that kind of serious chat about good alternatives to the triple lock and what actually is a fair state pension. The Institute for Fiscal Studies, for example, has published ideas around a link to median average earnings. And to be honest, until there's that sensible cross-party discussion, nobody wins. So pensioners are not feeling they've got security and certainty on what kind of pension they'll get in later life. And then this divide between the young and the old, or the have and the have-nots, is just going to continue to fester.
Yeah, it's an absolute political hot potato, and I guarantee we'll hear more about it whenever an election is called. Fascinating one.
Okay, so as we actually promised at the beginning of this episode, this pod is our ISA special. So we're heading towards tax year end, and the latest episode of AJ Bell's Money Matters podcast has actually been taking a deep dive into some of the things to think about now and as we come into that new financial year come the 6th of April. Danny and Laura have also put listener questions to financial advisor Jane Gow, and you'll find that pod wherever you find this one. But of course, come the 6th of April, all of these ISA allowances are going to reset, so you can square away another £20,000 from the taxman if you've got it. Now, even if you don't get anywhere near to using up your allowances, or you didn't last year, the new financial year is always a great time to kind of think about your finances, your ISAs, and what's in them.
Now, if like me, you're always eager to know what friends and family have bought when they go to the shops, well, the same applies to investing. What have they put in their portfolio? Why do they like it? Well, To give us some insights into the habits of AJ Bell customers, let's bring on Dan Coatsworth, who's been analysing the most popular stocks, funds and trusts held in ISAs. Dan.
Yeah, thanks, Danny. So I think before I sort of jump into some names, it's really important to understand with investing that we've all got different reasons why we invest. We've all got different risk appetites, which means just because someone is doing something doesn't mean to say it would work for someone else. But I thought we're in this ISA season at the moment, and I thought there's probably two interesting ways that we could look at what's going on at the moment. So first of all, I looked at the net buys. So what's popular so far this year with AJ Bell customers in terms of what is the most popular things they're putting through their ISAs? And there is one ETF, which is like a version of a tracker fund, which stands out above everything else, and that is a Vanguard S&P 500 ETF. And so what this is, there's lots of products that do exactly the same thing. Essentially, it's a tracker fund that is mirroring the performance of the US stock market. So US has been a really good place to make money in recent years. It continues to be the case at the moment. Lots of people looking there for opportunities particularly for big technology companies, like names like Meta Platforms, Nvidia, Amazon. They've all been having a pretty good time on the stock market. So it's understandable if you're investing into an ISA, perhaps you're thinking medium to long term, and understandably, a tracker fund is a really easy way to just get exposure to lots of different things without you having to worry about should I be sort of choosing individual stocks there. Now, in second place is City of London Investment Trust, which is it's not the sort of typical thing that you might expect someone to put into an ISA if they're chasing sort of big growth opportunities. This is sort of a portfolio, mostly of FTSE 100 companies, and typically more sort of stodgy stuff. And this is particularly popular with people in retirement. It pays sort of just above average dividend yield. And I think they're sort of stodgy stocks that will just get on and quietly do the job. Obviously, the UK market is very sort of cheap relative to other parts of the world. You can understand why people are sort of hunting there, particularly for income opportunities. Other names that are being really popular this year with ISA investors have been JP Morgan Global Growth and Income. It does what it says on the tin. It's got a mixture of growth stocks, and also it pays a slightly sort of bigger income than you might expect for, say a global tracker fund. And good old Nvidia as well. So this is the chip company that is everyone's excited about, keeps going very, very fast. And I think this is sort of an element of sort of FOMO, fear of missing out. I mean, Danny, you comment a lot on Nvidia. Does it still excite you? Or do you think, oh, crikey, I've had enough of not enough talking about Nvidia?
Well, it does still excite me. And we were just talking about Nvidia with its new AI chip, which everyone is now jumping up and down about, because it just does seem to have cornered the market when it comes to AI. And I think because it is all about productivity, and when businesses are thinking hard about cash, what they spend, making sure they make the most of the money, AI creates productivity. So yeah, I'm still really excited by Nvidia and talking about it.
So the other thing I wanted to talk about was just what people who are millionaires holding with an ISA. So this is people, AJ Bell customers got more than £1 million in their ISA. And of course, it brings a totally different dynamic. You think, okay, they've been really successful with their investing strategy. Wouldn't it be great if we could all look to see what the millionaires are doing? And should we copy them? Again, I go back to the thing I just said earlier. Everyone's strategies are different. Risks appetites are different. But what the common thing I think when I look at what the millionaires hold is that they've probably got as boring stocks as you could possibly choose. So things like Shell, Lloyds, Glaxo, Smith Klein, BP. Of course, the common thread here is dividends. And the thing to think about is that the average age of an AJ Bell ISA millionaire is 72. So they're going to almost certainly be in retirement at that sort of that mid average age. Just think about how powerful those dividends might be. So if you had £1 million portfolio and it was yielding 4%, you'd be getting £40,000 income a year purely off those investments. I mean, that has got to be a sort of a dream of so many people to be able to sort of just, you know, that's a salary that some people don't even earn in their, you know, their full-time job. So in terms of funds, Fundsmith and Rathbone Global, Lindsletrain Global, these three funds are really, really popular amongst Asia Bell ISA millionaires. And they're all investing around the world in companies that got sort of deemed to be have quality characteristics that should do well, even in sort of harder times. Scottish Mortgage, and of course we're going to be hearing from the manager in a little bit on the podcast. That's incredibly popular, along with the City of London, which I mentioned earlier. And we've also got names like Hickel Infrastructure Merchants Trust, which is again goes back to these are high yielding ones. It's all about the dividends. So I think if over the years, if you're investing in and you're, you know, whether you're in your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and you don't need cash from dividend payments, if you reinvest them, it really helps to compound those returns over time. So just because someone's got a dividend or income paying investment in their portfolio doesn't necessarily mean that they simply have it to collect the cash. It might be they're trying to do that real compounding trick, make it work its magic.
Thanks, Dan. Yes, and as Dan mentioned, one of the most popular holdings in AJ Bell's customers' ISAs is the Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust. So its share price hit dizzying heights back in 2021. Then it took a steep dive at the beginning of the next year after it got caught up in the sell-off of technology stocks. But whilst those stocks have recovered, Scottish Mortgage hasn't quite enjoyed the same return to form. So Danny caught up with Lawrence Burns, who's deputy manager of the trust, to get to the bottom of why.
Lawrence, first of all, thank you so much for joining us on the Money and Markets podcast. Investors that had got used to stonking performances from Scottish Mortgage, the last couple of years have been a bit difficult, I think it's fair to say. What's been behind that?
Yeah, I think over the last couple of years, you can really account for most of it by looking at the three major headwinds that I think Scottish Mortgage have faced. The first has been the historic rise of interest rates. So rates have gone up 11 times in that period over the last 2 years. And that's reduced the value the market has been willing to assign to the future profits of our companies. And that's particularly pertinent to growth companies, which is what we do, because most of their profits are further out in the future. We expect to grow a lot. And that's caused a significant contraction in the valuations of our portfolio companies. So that would be reason one. The second reason would be that many of our digital companies really did very well during the pandemic because people embraced digital services during lockdowns. As those lockdowns ended, we haven't seen those digital companies really give up those gains, but the lifestyle readjustment has been a headwind to growth that's meant for a slower pace of growth in the last couple of years than the previous years. And so they've had to adjust to that new reality, and that's caused a headwind to growth for some of the portfolio. The third reason was that around 20% of the portfolio, if you go back 2 or 3 years ago, was invested in Chinese companies. And they've been long-term, very positive contributors to our performance. But the last couple of years, they've suffered from a combination of geopolitical tensions of the US and a regulatory clampdown. So if you put those three things together, historic rises in interest rates, return to life after the pandemic, and China tensions, I think it goes a long way to explain the difficulties that you alluded to over the last couple of years. But also, I think if you think through each of them now, the picture is a bit rosier. The historic interest rate rises have ceased, removing that headwind that had been hitting our portfolio companies over the last couple of years. Indeed, the consensus is we're now heading into a period of interest rate cuts, potentially turning that headwind into a tailwind. China is now a much smaller proportion of the portfolio from here. We've sold over £800 million net of Chinese assets. And at the same time, we're seeing signs that the regulatory approach has at least become softer and more constructive towards the companies that we still own. But it's a much smaller part of the portfolio from here. Still one that we're excited about, but it's a smaller size going forward.
There's been huge amounts of momentum on global markets, particularly. I'm thinking of the Nikkei, I'm thinking of the NASDAQ and the S&P. We've seen new records breaking pretty much on a weekly basis over the last few weeks, perhaps a sign of a bit of a correction over the last couple of days. But Scottish Mortgage is still down considerably from those 2021 highs. Does the China portion of things represent the reason for all of that, or are there other things at play here?
I think there's a couple of things at play. I mean, the markets you were alluding to, the indexes, the S&P and the NASDAQ, have delivered very strong returns. And now, as you know, most of that's come from a very narrow selection of US companies, the so-called Magnificent Seven. We own some of those that have done very well, like NVIDIA, Amazon, and Tesla, but we haven't owned all of them. And I don't think that's particularly worrying, because actually I think we have a large portion of our portfolio in non-US companies and in private holdings that are doing very well and have a lot of potential to come from here, but haven't seen that same level of recognition as some of the US tech companies have. And so for us, that progress, we hope, is still to be recognized by the market. It's not all China, but I think it's just a combination of a particular subset of US stocks driving the market, some of the lack of recognition for some of our non-US businesses and the private businesses not yet coming through. But the progress we're seeing sort of under the bonnet, as it were, in terms of operations, really gives us confidence of where we're heading in the next few years ahead.
Do you feel that you've missed out because you've not had all of those Magnificent Seven stocks in the portfolio over the last couple of years?
I mean, I think in some ways you can look at the NASDAQ and go, it would have been nicer for us to be able to deliver that type of growth rate. But ultimately, as we look at the portfolio, it's about what's going to happen in the future and about being forward-looking. And I think here we're able to find companies that have a combination of good progress, good underlying fundamentals, and haven't had that recognition yet. So I don't think it's far too early in some ways to say we've missed out, because I think a lot of what's happened in the US is telling you a few things. It's telling you that technology is not dead post the pandemic, which was one of the narratives that we were sort of dealing with a couple of years ago. It's telling you that the potential for AI is huge, and we think it has beneficiaries that go beyond those Magnificent Seven. And we're willing to be patient to see that come through.
Which of the companies in your portfolio do you expect to deliver the most growth, particularly looking within that lens of AI and technology?
Well, I think we're in the fortunate position that we have a number of companies that are delivering really quite tremendous growth. NVIDIA is one that's been growing triple digits, for example, and is really building out the infrastructure of intelligence globally. And that's been a major beneficiary. Equally, that's filtered through into some of the semiconductor names we own, such as ASML, which is supporting that build out of GPUs. And then we have other companies as well, such as MercadoLibre, that are still very early in their journey in both e-commerce and fintech and delivering very high 40% US dollar growth rates and could grow to be a multiple of its size. And so I think the exciting thing for us is if you look down the portfolio and we go through it, actually, there's a number of companies that we think could be substantially larger 5 years from now.
And something which in many ways sets Scottish Mortgage apart is your continued investment in private companies. Have you got any plans to change the focus or to change the proportion of investments set aside for those?
Yes, so private companies for us, I think, is really a core part of what Scottish Mortgage is about, because it provides us access to unlisted companies that are very hard to otherwise get access to for savers. As an individual, can't just go out and buy shares in SpaceX, and even if you were able to, you'd be paying much for higher fees. And we're able to own up to 30% in private companies, and we continue to feel comfortable with that flexibility our shareholders have given us. Now, the proportion invested in private companies does move around a lot, depending on the valuations of our public companies and our private companies. And when IPOs of our private companies happen as well, it's not a static number. And over the last couple of years, we have had periods where capacity has been tight. But what we found was that companies would understand that and offer us flexible closes that allowed us to put money in at a future point when we did have capacity. So that enabled us not to miss out on the investment opportunity. And the company would still get the support they needed for the business, which is crucial. So that made the limit far less problematic than I think people have sometimes assumed. And right now we feel comfortable with our guidelines and we have a material amount of unlisted capacity available. So we see the private proportion as completely critical to delivering long-term returns. We think there are a number of companies in there, to your question about what could drive growth, well, SpaceX, ByteDance, Tempus, all of those really could. And we feel comfortable with where we are at the moment in terms of that 30% limit.
Just thinking about ByteDance that you mentioned there, clearly there are concerns that there could be some regulatory hurdles. Joe Biden potentially planning to ban ByteDance in the US, TikTok in the US. That could have a material impact on returns there.
Well, I think the thing that's interesting about ByteDance is, you know, if you look at where the profits and the value is today, it's really driven entirely in many ways by Douyin, which is the Chinese version of TikTok in China. And so the US part of that is actually quite small as the overall value. Now, there's a big opportunity if they get to keep that asset, but it's not actually what's driving a lot of the growth in profits today. And I think the other aspect is that, you know, people are very used to this genuine risk of TikTok being banned in the US. You know, that's going back to the Trump administration when they were talking about it. And the business has continued to grow and become a larger part of American society since then. We'll see what happens in the future. But what you're getting is an asset that many people have tried to price in that risk. And actually, we think is a company that is growing revenues and profitability at an astonishing rate, and yet has a valuation that almost prices it for X growth. And so that to us is very, very attractive.
I guess that sometimes it'd be really nice to have a crystal ball that you can just gaze into and know exactly what is coming down the pike. But just in terms of private companies, is there anything that could make it easier for you? And I'm thinking particularly for investors, it's sometimes hard to get valuations. It's hard to quantify that, you know, without sort of fundraising or IPOs. It's hard for investors to be able to understand what some of these companies are worth.
Yeah, so I think that's been one of our challenges over the last couple of years, is to provide more information to our shareholders on our private companies, because we see that exposure as a strength, not a weakness. And I think there's been a communication challenge there, because we're limited sometimes of what we can say about the private companies to the outside world due to NDAs and due to confidentiality. And so conveying some of those enthusiasms becomes tricky. And I think one of the problems has been much of the private equity world revalues companies, as you say, based on funding rounds. And the problem is, when you don't have funding rounds, those valuations can become stale. They become out of date. And that's particularly the case when market conditions change. However, our approach has been different. We don't value companies infrequently. We don't value them just on funding rounds. We actually revalue them constantly. So for example, over the last 18 months to June 2023, we made over 870 revaluations. Every quarter, we revalue our private companies, and we do that by doing a third of the portfolio every month. And then in addition to that, we also have trigger events that lead us to immediately revalue a private holding. Trigger event could be a funding round, but it could also be a change in operational performance, or it could be a change in the valuation of similarly publicly listed companies. And that allows us to feed in any changes in the public market valuations into our private. And we've also been trying to share more information operationally on our private company. Now, again, we've done that in terms of the top 10 private holdings, because they account for 2/3 of the total exposure, and they allow us to say a lot without coming into any problems in terms of information disclosure. But if you look at the top 10 private holdings, I mean, they grew their revenues 38% in 2022 by weight, nearly half already generating cash already. So fast growing and far more profitable than is often assumed for private companies. So we're hoping that the provision of this information, which is available on our website, is helping people look at these private companies in a different light. The valuations are up to date, that they're actually more profitable than many people think, and they're actually doing and growing very well. It's one of the parts of the portfolio that we're most excited by.
Do you think you've been hindered by the fact that just generally there's been a lack of IPOs? And I suppose investors are wondering if the reason for that is that these companies just aren't ready for IPO.
Well, a lot of, you know, look at those top 10 companies that make up the vast majority. They're completely ready to IPO. Have, you know, half of them are already generating cash, so that isn't a problem. What is a question mark for our larger private companies is now the right time to list? Am I going to get a value that is fair for my business, or am I better to wait a year or two and get an even higher value? And I think the very best companies, that's what they've been grappling with. It's not we're unable to list, it's that we want the best possible price for our business. And that's what we're seeing more and more again. And so the IPOs to me haven't been a problem, particularly in their lack of or shown any signs of weakness in the companies. Where it has caused an impact has been that Obviously, if you have an IPO of a private company, that reduces your private company exposure. And we haven't had many of those. We did have one last year, which was Oddity, which went public successfully. And as we look forward, we obviously hope the next few years, markets will be a bit more open to IPOs. And we've got a number of companies in the portfolio that are open to take advantage of that. Because again, you know, these are large, private, profitable businesses, some of these. These are not all early stage startups that are heavily loss-making.
Any that particularly come to mind that might IPO in the next year or so?
Well, I'd make a general statement and then I'll try and help a bit with the specifics there. I mean, firstly, a general statement would be that we are seeing a change in the market environment. We're getting more testing the water emails from companies and banks that are representing them than we've had for a very long time. And that's when companies are looking to meet investors and to gauge appetite ahead of a potential listing. Just last week, I was offered multiple such meetings, and that's a stark difference from a year or two ago. And then if you look at our companies in particular, in many ways, I can only repeat sort of what's out in the press, but you've had speculation that Starlink, which is part of SpaceX, providing sort of global internet coverage, may be a business that sort of looks to IPO. You've had press coverage around similarly around Northvolt. So I think there's a lot of different options if the market improves. It's not possible for us to say which one will happen when or what the most likely one is, but I think people are starting to realize there's a change in the environment there.
And on the flip side, just today as we're recording this, there's a small UK-listed company called LoopUp, which is deciding to delist because it thinks that things will be better for it as a private company. Is that just a quirk in the UK? I mean, I know you're very globally focused, but it does say something about the market, and there are a lot of concerns about UK markets at the moment.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the individual company that you mentioned there, so I can't really comment on the specifics of it. What I would say is that I think one of the conversations we always have with our private companies is trying to make sure they're aware of the downsides of being a publicly listed business. The public markets force you to be a lot more short-term because you get on a quarterly earnings treadmill, you have to deliver earnings every quarter, you have a share price that becomes inevitably your scorecard, and it may not at times be a fair scorecard, and that can affect decision-making, it can affect morale. So I think we see the negatives of being a public company, and that's why we spend quite a lot of time trying to convey those to companies so they can have a smoother journey as possible. So I do have sympathy for people that say, isn't it better to be private? But ultimately what it comes down to is, at some point businesses do grow, they need liquidity for their employees, and that becomes a natural part of the process. But we're willing to support our companies to stay private as long as it remains within the best interests of them as a business.
And as we know, you are incredibly outwardly focused, very globally focused. But in the budget, the Chancellor announced the creation of a British ISA. What are your immediate thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I mean, we would welcome the inclusion of Scottish Mortgage and any other investment trust in a British ISA. However, I think, like everyone else, we'll be waiting to see what details of the ISA will be once it's finalised.
Do you think Scottish Mortgage would fit into that? Because clearly, just thinking about the makeup of Scottish Mortgage, it's incredibly outwardly focused. A lot of global stocks, very few British stocks.
Yeah, that's fair. So we have two UK companies in our portfolio, Ocado, doing automated grocery, and Wise. And Wise we've actually backed since a private company, so a long time now. But you're right, most of our investments today are outside of the UK. But then that's not actually too dissimilar if you look at many of the constituents, the FTSE 100, who also have their operations coming from outside the UK and a lot of profits as well. And you know, I think for SM, it would be great if in the future we could find more exceptional UK growth businesses. And so in the future, it's quite hard to know what the long-term makeup of the portfolio will be. And ultimately, Scottish Mortgage is a UK company and it is a UK listed trust.
I want to just end by talking about the health sector. Just over 5% of your portfolio is held in Moderna, a company that's struggled on the stock market for the past few years. So why do you still hold it? What makes you decide to keep hold of a company that seems to be underperforming?
Well, okay, I think it's helpful to take a step back. If you didn't hold companies when they underperformed, you'd end up missing out on some of the greatest growth companies in the world. Everyone is talking about NVIDIA now, and everyone is talking about AI, and it's, you know, now a $2.3, $2.4 trillion company. But you only had to go back 2 years ago, and the share price fell 60, 70%. And so there's a similar question there of why would we own an underperforming company then? And the obvious answer is because we don't think that reflects its value. We think it has a very bright, significant long-term future. And that's similar to where we are with Moderna. Now, we have to accept that we'll get things wrong as we go along, but it's holding on for that potential of a very large home run for our clients and shareholders. And when we look at Moderna, actually the progress they've made outside of COVID, it's not come through yet to revenues, but in terms of the scientific validation, the technology validation platform, that's been very strong. The fact that they've come up with a personalized cancer vaccine that shows it can cut death rates by about 44% versus the standard of care, that is really quite impressive. And to be quite frank, we weren't actually predicting it to have that level of success in cancer and opening up that entire new modality. And so for us, Moderna, yes, revenues and profits have gone backwards as one would have expected as COVID became less of an issue. But for us, it's about using mRNA as a broader platform, not just for cancer, but for other infectious diseases. They've got a flu vaccine that showed really great efficacy. They've got RSV. And that for us underlines a very, very long-term opportunity where we think the market is struggling to really look beyond the guessing game of what COVID revenues and profits will be in the next year. But for us, it's really about everything beyond COVID. And that's where the majority of the value we think lies. And if Moderna is successful in that promise, there's a possibility that it could be a very large multiple of its current value.
Lawrence, thank you so much for talking to us.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Lawrence Burns there, Deputy Manager of Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust. Right, let's continue our ISA special. Lots of wannabe first-time buyers might have considered a lifetime ISA to help with their deposit savings. But if you've not heard of it, it's a pretty powerful way to get free money towards your first home. Laura Souter's here to talk about how it works, but also how it can add thousands and shave off years from your deposit saving journey. That's in comparison to using a standard ISA. Laura, tell us more.
So I'll cover the basics of the lifetime ISA first, because lots of people might not have used it or even heard of it. And it's such a valuable ISA if you're saving either for your first home or for retirement. But there are some trickier bits to it that you just need to get your head around. So you can pay £4,000 a year into it each tax year. That counts as part of your overall £20,000 ISA allowance. But the really good bit about it that differentiates it from other ISAs is that the government will pay in government bonus on top of that money. So for every £4 you pay in, they will pay in £1. And so that means if you pay the maximum £4,000 in, then you get £1,000 from the government, free money to go towards your deposit savings. So that's a huge boost for anyone trying to save to get onto the housing ladder. But the kind of tricky criteria is you have to be between the age of 18 and 39 to be able to open the account. So if you've hit your 40th birthday, sadly, you have missed the boat on the lifetime ISA. And there's kind of a bit of a tie up to it. So if you want to access the money for any other reason other than to buy your first home or at the age of 60, then you will have to pay a kind of exit penalty on the money that you take out. So people shouldn't see this as an easy access, dip in and out of it each month kind of account. It should be money that they envisage being locked away for the longer term, albeit they can access that money if they needed to in an emergency. And so it's that kind of government bonus part of it, coupled with investing. If you opt for the investment version, there's a cash lifetime ISA and an investment lifetime ISA. But the government bonus coupled with investing over the longer term that can really put the rockets under your deposit savings.
So how's it work differently to a regular ISA?
Yeah, so I think those two components together mean that you can really save for that deposit for longer. So I did some number crunching. We all know I love a spreadsheet. So I've dived into the spreadsheet and looked at one of the things that people struggle with is they're saving for a deposit today, but the time period it takes them to save for a deposit, by that point, house prices have gone up and their deposit is no longer enough. And so I looked at some calculations and basically forecast what the average house price might be in 10 years time, and then the deposit that you would need for that. So if you wanted a 10% deposit for the average house in 10 years time, you'd need to have saved £54,000, which is sounds like a huge amount of money. But if you use the lifetime ISA, then that equates to saving £3,250 a year over that 10-year period. Then that gets topped up with the government bonus. Then you get investment growth over that 10 years and you get to that £54,000 over that period. The other great thing with the lifetime ISA is if you're buying with another first-time buyer, you can both pay money into your own separate lifetime ISAs. You both get that government bonus. So actually that £3,250 a year figure that I talked about, you can chop that in half if you're planning to buy with a partner or a friend or a family member. So you can see how that huge figure that we're talking about in terms of deposit levels, actually, if you break it down and you look over that 10-year period, it's a bit more manageable. And I think one of the other figures that I looked at is comparing it to if you just saved in a normal ISA, which I think some people see as kind of the default for their savings. If you invested the maximum £4,000 a year that you can put into a lifetime ISA over 10 years, by using the lifetime ISA rather than a standard ISA, you'll get an extra £13,000 in your savings pot over that 10 years. And that's because you've benefited from the government bonus on that money. So based on those calculations, it's the maximum £1,000 a year that you could get. You've got investment growth on your own money, but you've also got investment growth on that government bonus over the 10 years. And so I think that figure, even on its own, really highlights how you can really supercharge those deposit savings. Of course, you need to check the kind of terms and conditions and the small print of the account to make sure it works for you and that you're eligible for it. But hopefully that highlights how just using it for that home buying purpose can be really, really effective over the longer term.
Thank you, Laura. Right, Charlene, we're going to end on junior ISAs. First, for people who aren't aware of them, explain what they are.
Yeah, so a junior ISA is another tax-free account and it lets you put away up to £9,000 a tax year for a child under 18. So a couple of things to be aware of. It's got to be set up and managed by the parent or guardian of the child, but actually anyone can then put money into it. It just counts as a gift to the child. So that could build up a really nice little fund to cover a deposit on a first home or cover university tuition fees. Now, another big thing to remember is with junior ISAs, you can't usually get the money once it's paid in. It is a gift to that child. And then when the child turns 18, it matures into an ISA of their very own. So there's a cash flavor as well as an investment one, which we offer at AJ Bell.
And I know there's been a lot of talk and headlines over the past couple of weeks about the changes to the child benefit high income thresholds, which could mean some parents now have a windfall coming their way and might want to think about junior ISAs.
Yeah, so from the 1st of April, the point at which you'll have to start repaying the full amount of child benefit rises from £60,000 to £80,000. So the biggest winners here are going to be households where each parent actually earns £60,000 each, because they'll go from having nothing, not being able to claim anything, or having to pay it all back, to being able to claim the whole amount. So this is actually hand in hand with a rise in the benefit that will come in from the 1st of April. So it's going up to £25.60 a week for the eldest child, and then £16.95 a week for each additional one.
Now, of course, a lot of people will find that that cash just disappears into your household budget. But the reason that we're talking about that child benefit high income threshold and junior ISAs together, because if you haven't been receiving the money and you can get away with putting it away, there is an opportunity to turn that windfall into a seriously sizable nest egg for your kids in a junior ISA.
There is, and Laura's not the only one who can do some number crunching in a spreadsheet. I've been enjoying myself as well. I'm not sure if that means we need to get out more. But yeah, if you're in the position where you can do without that money being swallowed up into your weekly spend, investing it every month for 18 years could turn it into nearly £50,000. I mean, that would give your child an incredible start to their adult lives. So assuming that the child benefit rises on average at 3% a year and you get investment returns of 5% a year, if you've got two children, investing that unexpected kind of extra windfall could actually reach £81,800. You might want to split it between the two neatly, just to be fair, because obviously that child benefit starts at a higher rate for the first child and slightly less. We don't want to be perpetuating any of those second child generalizations there. But bear in mind a couple of things with child benefit. Those payments won't just automatically start to come your way if you're not currently claiming it. So perhaps if you are kind of at that £60,000 level. So there'll be a bit of online admin to kind of do and logging onto the government gateway there. So if the junior ISA lock puts you off kind of having it locked until 18 and then it all becoming the child's own money, and you'd rather still have control of the money yourself, you could look to invest it in your own stocks and shares ISA, but you will need enough of your own ISA allowance to do this each year. And perhaps if you are putting it away, really is that kind of university or house deposit nest egg, like not be tempted to dip into it in the short term, of course. So on one final little note, that the kind of change in thresholds that I've talked about, so that higher limit going up from 60,000 to 80, that was billed as kind of a quick fix now, whilst the government consults on whether they need to look at like household income as a measure to use in the test. So this has rightly raised some eyebrows as well, because it goes against the kind of fundamental UK principle of individual or independent taxation. The consultation isn't open yet. And, you know, if a carve-out for one area of UK taxation looks too complicated at the end of it, it's likely that those kind of higher individual thresholds will actually be the way forward and give a bit of certainty for planning.
Thank you, Charlene. Thanks all of you for joining us for this ISA special. Next week, Dan and Laura are going to be in the hot seat with all the latest markets news, including any fallout from those interest rate decisions.
Yeah, and Tom and Steve from Shares Magazine are going to take a deep dive into Apple. And Dan's been chatting to Ewan Marks and Brown from Crux Asset Management about the future of EV stocks. Until then, thanks for listening.
Before you go, please remember this podcast is for educational purposes, and the views expressed don't necessarily reflect those of AJ Bell or Shares Magazine. The podcast isn't telling you if a certain investment is suitable or not. Don't forget that the value of investments can change, and you can lose money as well as make it. It's also important to remember that how you're taxed will depend on your individual circumstances, and rules can change. The way an investment performed in the past may not be the same as how it behaves in the future. If you want help, go see a qualified financial advisor.